All right. Just while we're getting set up, are we up here? Okay. Our first guest is the producer of Good Morning Vietnam, Rain Man, Donnie Brasco, The Notebook, and the Narnia series. Please welcome Mark Johnson. Our second guest is the writer of the films Home Fries and Hancock, and longtime writer and producer of my other favorite television series, The X-Files. I've been waiting months to utter the following phrase. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Vince Gilligan.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So, creator, writer, director of this episode, showrunner. But for me, the core of any effective series is the writing, and it builds from there, and it makes or breaks. And like any thoughtful, organized writer, you introduce your thesis early. So looking at Breaking Bad as a text in the pilot of the series, in a speech that Walt gives his high school chemistry class, he says that chemistry is the study of matter, but I prefer to see it as the study of change, solution, dissolution, over and over and over. It is growth, then decay, then transformation. Looking at Walt as matter, how have you seen him go through those stages?
Well, Walt has definitely, if you watch from the pilot, he has gone through a heck of a lot of changes, definitely. This is a show, in a sense, about change and transformation and metamorphosis, which is a little unusual for TV, in the sense that TV is very good. All of our favorite TV shows are, if you think about them, are studies in consistency. You watch MASH. In 1972, you watch the first episode of the TV show MASH, and they're in the middle of this 18-month, police action in Korea. 11 years later, 1983, they're still in the middle of this 18-month police action, and that's a wonderful thing. TV is a place that you tune in every week at the same time, same station, and watch your favorite people or people who interest you, and this show is trying to do something a little different than that. We're trying to actively, with every week's episode, we're trying to take a guy from point A and take him all the way to point Z, take him from being a good guy, being the protagonist of the show, to the antagonist of the show. The way I pitched it to AMC way back when we were trying to get on the air was, I said, we're going to take Mr. Chips and we're going to turn him into Scarface. I hadn't thought of it that way, but in a sense, the thesis of the show is somewhat summed up in that bit of dialogue you quoted.
I mean, even in series that are very dynamic and do break molds, there's still studies in fully formed characters. We meet Tony Soprano and Dexter Morgan and Don Draper fully formed. We meet Walt when he is a dorky, pleated khaki, cheap shirt wearing high school teacher.
And he still wears those same crappy clothes though, doesn't he?
but they're black now.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And that spaghetti western homage at the beginning, we don't get the guy in white. We get two guys in black. How have you seen him sort of approach the something more like the Mike character, especially in the last season?
Well, it's a very astute thing you point out about the color palette. We have wonderful help from an excellent production designer and an excellent wardrobe designer, and we talk color palettes at the beginning of every season. And indeed, as you put your finger on it, Walt's color palette has changed from very mild and somewhat boring beiges. Various shades of beige in season one, and then we brought him a little into green. Actually, we did a little microcosm of this just within the pilot. But every year, there's been a change in color palette for actually all the characters except for Marie, who you didn't see in this episode, who stays purple all the time because she's a very consistent character. But But the color is something we think a lot about, and I'm glad you noticed it.
And the color of the car, which I hear is not actually a color that exists on Pontiac Aztecs.
No. it's an ugly car to begin with, but we uglified it a little more.
It's not. I don't think it's even arguably. I think it simply is the dorkiest car on the planet.
Yeah. Well,
and I love that.
The AMC, it's funny, our network is AMC. The AMC Corporation that used to build cars, I think they had the lock on the ugliest ever. They had the Pacer and the Gremlin. But those have been used in Wayne's World and whatnot. So we had to find the new dorkiest car that had not been used, and luckily for us, that was the Pontiac Aztec. So yeah,
fantastic.
It's actually not a bad car though. I've driven that one, and it's got a center divider that you can pull out and use as a cooler. Take it on.
It's really easy to replace the windshields in two or three dozen times.
Yeah, that's right. We've only broken the windshield on the show five or six times now.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I love that blue tape on the edge. Yeah. I love that little color accent.
Yeah.
What Vince said in continuing the whole aspect of change and how the characters each episode and each season really become different from what you expect from them or what they were in the beginning. Vince said to me after the first season, as a description, a capsule description, is it's a show about a good man who makes a bad decision and keeps compounding that bad decision. And by the middle of the second season, he turned to me and he said, "I don't think he's a good man anymore."
Yeah. What was that point for you? When do you think you took that switch?
We had an episode in season two where he watches, Walter watches Jane, who is Jesse's girlfriend at the time, watches her die of a heroin overdose, watches her choke to death on her own vomit, and lets it happen, and does not stop it. He does not cause it to happen. Well, actually, even then you could argue he inadvertently caused it, but he doesn't stop it from happening, and for a very specific reason, because she's blackmailing him, and also he knows in a fatherly way almost, that this woman is actually very bad for Jesse. But at that moment, he doesn't do it lightly. It's a very rough moment for him as a character, but at that moment, you sort of realize as an audience that this guy's turned a very severe corner. So that was probably, would you say that was the moment?
Yeah.
And that moment is just such an interesting exercise in unintended consequences. He can grapple with the fact of allowing the death of one individual. But then what the result of that is her father, an air traffic controller, so distraught, causes the death of hundreds of people by causing a mid-air collision between two planes.
Right, yeah.
And there are these scenes of Walt and his family sitting in this room earlier in the series, then juxtaposed with the crack houses that Jesse sort of pops in and out of and these other places that are two entirely separate worlds.
That's well put. Yeah, there're definitely a lot of worlds colliding on this show, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, well put.
And how far are you able to plan ahead those worlds?
We are very lucky on this show. It's unusual. Having come from the X-Files, from a network show, which it was a wonderful job doing that job, being a writer on that show. Network shows, it's just the nature of the beast, the nature of the very tight schedules. You're writing, sometimes you're finishing up, you're writing an episode that shoots 2 days later. And luckily for us on Breaking Bad, we only do 13, basic cable is 13 a season versus 22 or 24 for network. And that's a big help for me personally. And the other thing that helps us is we work so far ahead just because of the vagaries of the schedule on the AMC network that right now we're figuring out the story of episode of season four. We started breaking season four, my writers and I, in Burbank 16, 17 weeks ago, and we won't start shooting it till January 13th or so. So we have a lot of lead time, and that way we get to try to be good chess players and try to think 20, 30 moves ahead. And we don't always succeed, but this lead time allows us the luxury of trying to think things through as much as we're humanly able to and think, are we forgetting some thread we left behind in season one or season two? Can we weave it back into season four? And it's if every show had the the good fortune to have that much lead time as we do. It'd be great for TV, and it's a fluke that we get to do it. But you'd see a lot of a lot fewer story threads being dropped on other TV shows if every writing staff had that amount of time. We're just lucky, but other staffs would be certainly capable of weaving these kind of intricate things if they just had more time, but that's not the nature of the beast usually.
And it seems like you enjoy that luxury too and kind of want to show off a little bit, especially in season two, those first images of that pink teddy bear floating in the pool, that you kind of go all through the season having no idea what the hell this thing is. And those final shots of season two, and you're just sitting there and you're like, Jesus Christ. This teddy bear, it's cute, it's disturbing, it's grotesque, but it's unknown for an entire season. So I was just going to say, that's just showing off at that point. Just showing off how far ahead you can plan.
We have the good fortune of having that kind of lead time, and we definitely enjoy using it to the fullest we're capable of. That was a tough season. We spent probably the first month in the room, the writer's room, just saying, all right, we want to do a circular season where we start with the first image, and that first image is also the last image of the season. Mm-hmm. So what the hell's going on? You know, and it took us about a month of just pounding our heads against the table till we figured out what the entirety of the story was.
This is before we meet any of the characters involved in that big punch at the end. We don't meet Jane or her father or anything.
And even then, we knew that it would be an airline disaster. It's designed to look like it was a meth lab explosion or some act of violence, and instead it's this airliner mid-air collision. We knew it would be a mid-air collision, but we didn't know exactly the mechanism, even as we move forward, in which it would play out. So there was still some unknown stuff to be, you know, some shoe leather to be, some pipe to be laid, you know.
And you sort of hint at that that conclusion through the episode titles of season two, is that right?
Yeah, they're hidden within every episode has a title, and I think the episodes in which we saw the flash forward, if you lay them out, they were 737, down, over, ABQ. So that was kind of hidden within the episode titles. And it's fun to get to do that kind of stuff. But we're trying to think of a good one for this season, but we haven't figured it out yet. So.
Well, you have a bit of a one in the episode we just saw, the two fireplace expounded shots of the house becoming a home. And that, to me, is also a big part of what this show is the evolution of this home and these family dynamics.
You want to write that down?
Yeah, I like that. It sounds good when you say it, yeah.
Well, how does it feel for you?
It's very well put, what you just said. That is what we were going for. I think you worded it better than I ever did to my fellow writers on the show, but I like what you said. It was the evolution. There's so much of this show so much of what we involve ourselves with is telling stories a little untethered from linear chronology. We jump back and forth through time a lot, and we enjoy being able to do that. A lot of the episodes leading up to this one would have teasers that jump way back in time, and then we certainly the season before had teasers at the beginning, the little bit before the title sequence every week, and so we have fun with the teasers, particularly where we jump back and forth through time.
Well, speaking of the teasers, and one of the reasons we're so sort of proud to be showing this and representing this series here at the Film Festival is that I truly do believe it's just some of the finest and truest cinema being made right now in visual storytelling. That first sequence of the season premiere of season three, mm-hmm. entirely wordless, silent, mm-hmm. men crawling and women crawling on their elbows and knees through the desert, telling a story somehow. And it's just... that's not done much.
Oh, thank you. Bryan Cranston directed that episode.
That's right.
Our star did a hell of a job. He's very talented. Well, thank you. We try very much to be cinematic with this show. We're hoping, and you and I haven't even talked about this, but we're hoping season four we can shoot true widescreen, 2.35 ratio widescreen. We're going to have a little bit of a, I don't want to say a battle, but... Maybe not. I don't know. I'm not sure yet. It's TV does not shoot in widescreen. You know, now that TVs are wider, the flat screens you hang on your TV, those are 16:9. That's still only, as you said, 178. So we're talking even wider with more of a letterbox, which
more spaghetti western sequences.
And we're going to use the exact
more
same.
Big eyes.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The process we'll use is a flat, not an anamorphic widescreen. If we get to do it, if we win our fight, it'll be a flat widescreen using Techniscope, which, if I have my knowledge, if I have my information correct, it was it's two perf widescreen instead of the three perf. We shoot 35 millimeter motion picture film. We're one of the last shows that does. Every other show's going to video now. But we shoot three perf 35, and we'd go down to two perf because it's more of a natural widescreen aspect ratio, and we'd save a third of our film stock costs. But that the Techniscope was invented, I guess, and used in the 60s and used by the Italians for all the spaghetti westerns. So it'll be another. I like this show. I like the show to look as much like a contemporary western as a western period as possible. And that'll be another link to the past, the fact that the spaghetti westerns were shot with the same two-perf Techniscope, if we get to do it.
We're very lucky that AMC is the cable network that we're on. The other show they have right now is Mad Men, and they came from showing classic movies, and they said to us from very early on, we insist on being on film. We're the movie network. And we want our shows to look like movies, and so that we're one of the few, as Vince says, still shoots on film. And you couldn't quite tell from this because it's the image is so stretched out, but we really have some spectacular vistas. And it does at times it reminds me of something like the Coen brothers would do in No Country for Old Men, or it just and Albuquerque is a perfect place to shoot this show because it lends itself to these vistas and has amazing, amazing clouds all the time.
Yeah.
You can represent just about any mood you want them to.
Yeah. And having said that, there's nothing wrong with video. I didn't mean to make it sound that way. It's the future, and we're kind of still writing with quill pens, in a sense, shooting film. But, yeah, we love film. So, but video is going to take it all over any day now, any year now. So.
But you'll keep up the old guard.
As long as we can, but I mean, there's nothing wrong. Video looks fantastic now. It's you know, just different tools for your toolbox there, film versus HD video. So.
Well, a tool that doesn't change is the pen or the keyboard. Your writing is always writing, and it's obvious that you had a lot of fun doing so, especially in this episode. I mean, how much fun was that mic sequence?
That mic sequence was fun. It was very cold. I had not directed an episode since the pilot. And the pilot, I had 16 days. And this was a regular old episode where we have 8 days to shoot. So I had never done an hour of TV in 8 days before, because the X-Files, back when we did that, was 11 to 13 days. So this was tough. It was a challenge. And the only way I got through it was because we have a wonderful director of photography and a wonderful crew who just moved like the wind. And I was just, you know, with my sandwich in my hand saying, you know, can you... And we have a wonderful crew, and they make it all work. But that sequence was fun. It was colder than hell. It was shot back at the end of January, and we were in this abandoned warehouse that our wonderful production designer had turned into a working chemical warehouse. And the damn gun that H&K, whatever, that silenced pistol, that damn thing kept misfiring. It's every other take it would, you know, click and nothing happens because they had the wrong blanks in it or something. But you know, and that kind of thing is like, oh shit, we're running out of time. We got another 3 hours, and you know, take after take, you got to set up. It was a hassle, but it was fun. It was fun. I was lucky to get to do it. So.
And to have such a short period of time for a show, you cover such great ground in this one. You get to explore all the secondary characters with Mike and Gail and Saul. And who are all sort of relatively recent additions to the show? Do you want to sort of maybe think about how they introduced themselves to you and your mind and made their way into the series?
Well, Saul, the lawyer with his weird that's called a chi machine. And it actually looks stupid, but it feels good, actually. You kind of go like this, and then you get up, and you kind of have a head rush afterward. I don't know why, but it's, I don't know. But Bob Odenkirk, who plays Saul Goodman, is a wonderful actor, and we came up with a character, and then Bob came to us to play the character back in season two, and he exists at least initially for two reasons. One of them was we figured Walt needed a consigliere, much like Michael Corleone needs a consigliere in Godfather. But this is the kind of consigliere Walter White would get, you know, this guy. But also, this is a dark show, and it's not obviously for every taste, but we try to lighten it up whenever and wherever we can, even though our idea of light is still pretty dark humored. But any laughs that he can bring to the show are always welcome. And
well, it's evident even in his name, Saul.
Saul Goodman.
That's Saul Goodman?
Yeah, Saul Goodman. Yeah, his real name is McGill. The character's real name is McGill. He puts it on for the, you know, he's one of those billboard bus bench lawyers who puts it on for the clients, the specific clientele that he has. So, yeah.
And then we've got sort of Gail the grad student, this amazing sycophant who's just so enamored of Walter and wants to be perfect for him, which is makes it all the more devastating of a blow at the end.
It's like, you know, the whole scene with him singing that wonderful old 40s, what is it? It's an Italian song from the 40s called Crapa Pelata, and just that scene of him singing it is just, you know, writer-wise, it's just, you know, here's an adorable puppy. Now, let's see him get clubbed in the head at the end of the... writing-wise, that's what's the point of showing all that, but he's... David Costable, who plays Gale, wonderful actor. He really does have a beautiful singing voice.
Yeah.
We didn't know that when we cast him, when we came up with this bit, but it didn't really matter whether he could sing or not. It didn't matter if his voice was wonderful or not. But he actually does Broadway shows and stuff. He's not playing a meth cook for us. So
if he's the adorable puppy, what do we see Walt as being at this point?
I think Walt's a bastard. I mean, he should have gone to the cops. He should. I mean, you know, the thing we're trying to do with our show is we're not trying to shake anybody loose as viewers, but we are trying to be. And it could be argued, you know, we're seeing how bad Walt can get, and if people will still sympathize and or at least stay interested to keep watching, we're not trying to shake anyone loose in that endeavor, but we are trying to. I mean, trying to be as realistic as possible within the confines of telling a hopefully interesting story week in and week out. But I mean, this is a nasty business he's in. There's not much admirable about being a meth cook for a living. It's not a particularly good drug. It doesn't do good things for the world. You know, it's and this guy at every turn could have made a different choice. And at least the way I see it. But we like the show. We like to. Just present the characters and let the audience argue and decide, you know, is he justified, at least at the beginning, was he justified in what he's doing, is he not? But it's interesting. We sit in a writer's room. It feels like being on a sequestered jury that never ends, but there's six writers and myself. We sit in a room out in this dumpy office in Burbank, and we sit day in and day out trying to figure out where Walt's head is at, you know, what is he going to do next, what is he afraid of, what's his fear, what's his hope, you know, we do that with all the characters, and then we ask ourselves the question over and over again, what happens next? And we try to keep the storytelling as organic as possible. In other words, we don't try to come up with a cool set piece and then somehow, you know, make them go in that direction, the characters, so that they do that set piece, but we try to keep them flowing organically. But we have the argument day in and day out, is this guy worth following anymore? Is he... I think he is, but I mean, you know, at a certain point, I feel like you stop sympathizing with him and you instead watch him out of interest for what he will do next, but you're not necessarily in sympathy with his choices because you realize if you watch the totality of the show, there are moments where he's been thrown a lifeline. He's been offered a job. He's been offered this or that. He's been offered a way out of this life. And for various reasons having to do with pride, mostly, he refuses to take these opportunities and instead continues on this path of criminality because he's getting a kick out of it. He's enjoying it. It's making him feel alive. It's making him feel like a man. So he's very much, shows very much a character study.
And we're so lucky that Bryan Cranston plays Walter White. I don't know if most of you know this, but he has won the Emmy for Best Actor 3 years in a row for this this character. It's remarkable.
He's a wonderful actor and a wonderful guy, and the show works. If it works for you, a big chunk of it is because, a big part of the reason it works is because of Bryan Cranston, who is, there's something just fundamentally decent. He's a wonderful actor. He has skill to burn, but he is also, you know, there are a lot of great actors out there, of which he is one, but he also has a sympathizability and a basic humanity that just, it's innate within him, that just sort of comes out of his eyes, comes out of his expression. Somehow you like the guy and you root for him, even when he's doing reprehensible things. So
even AMC wasn't sure when Vince wanted to cast him, because up till then he was known as the father and Malcolm in the Middle, and they said, how is this going to work? And
yeah.
Took you some doing to convince them that he was the right guy.
It helped that I had put him in an episode of the X-Files before, about 18 months before Malcolm in the Middle ever went on the air, and it was a very hardcore kind of character.
Drive.
It was an episode called Drive, and it was Agent Mulder and Bryan Cranston's character in a car for pretty much the whole 40-some minutes, and he was the character was a real bastard and a kind of a racist and a creep, and yet...
You like him.
And yet, at the end of it, when he dies, you say, hopefully, you like him on some level, and you feel sympathy for his death. And very few actors could pull that off. We saw dozens of them, and we were running out of time, and then Bryan Cranston walked in the room, and yeah, he can... When Malcolm in the Middle went on the air, and I was flipping through, I said, oh my God, that's Bryan Cranston. I worked with him. I didn't know he could be funny, and I had no idea how... The guy can do anything. He's amazing.
When did you realize that his cancer was going to go into remission and that he would? Because that changes how his character is defined in a very big way.
That is
he makes the decision to continue.
That is true. We, much like Walt does, we live, we don't live day to day, but we live season to season on our show, and we don't know how long we'll have. So it's hard to plot out, you know, year by year now. We'll get another year after the end of the previous year, we'll get another season. And so it's hard to know exactly how long we should plot out, how carefully, and we're always careful about it, it's hard to know exactly how to parcel out our story. So about midway through season three, we had Walt go into remission because we thought, you know, it looks like we're going to go a little longer here. Walt still has cancer. His character still has it. He is currently in remission as we enter season four. I wouldn't be surprised if it reared its ugly head again in the future. But that's the trick of knowing just how long you have, you know, ironically, just how long you have as a TV show. So you parcel it out as best you can.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned luck a couple of times and how it's informed the production of the series. It also shows up in the text of the series as well, especially in this episode. And I think a nice example of that is the moments that are or aren't interrupted by cell phone rings. I mean, if Jesse had taken that, if he had smoked just then before his phone rung, it would have been over.
Well,
and if Gail hadn't been blaring his music, he might have lived.
That's true. He might have lived. It's funny you mentioned he's about to take a hit of meth. I think it's funny, and I love these kind of discussions. It's what we're always hoping for when we come up with this stuff. To me, if he had had the hit, it would have made the job easier. Hmm. Oddly enough, he was about to smoke a bowl of meth there, and it would have perhaps, you know, having to do it sober made it tougher for him. Still, we're very tough on our characters on this show. So. But it's interesting to discuss those kind of moments, and there is no wrong answer to that. Maybe he would have not been able to pull it off. You know, it's very possible. The guy is on meth so much of the show that he's a pretty high functioning meth addict. So, but
there is that controversy I learned from Mark the other day, is whether the shot hit him.
Well, I don't want to ruin anything for anybody, so I'm going to kind of dodge. I will say this, for what it's worth, I never intended for there to be any ambiguity there. It seemed pretty clear to me, but...
Never occurred to me.
But it doesn't mean we won't change it. That doesn't mean we... Just, I don't want to give it away, but it doesn't mean we did change it either. So it doesn't mean anything. Don't read anything in anything. So,
well, something you should read into is the power and the way that words can direct a scene or an event or a point in someone's life, and a pair of scenes in here that illustrate the power of words and writing, and I think a really exquisite way, are the differences between Walt's and Gale's "Don't kill me" speeches. One works, one doesn't. And one's a much stronger speech, and one is sort of a puttering, mumbling, "Please don't do this."
Right.
Does that inform those characters more broadly to you, or is that sort of the way it had to just play out?
I like repeating moments and words and putting them into different characters' mouths. So it definitely, we made an effort to have this exact same line, "Please don't do this," repeated from, you know, as you said, to have the one character say it and then the other. And of course, one character, it's not that Walt doesn't mean it when he says it, but he is kind of putting on a show for the two killers who are about to execute him. So his is perhaps not as genuine as Gale's. Gale's is probably more the way I would do it personally, because I'd be peeing myself. And I mean, you know, when you face, I would imagine, luckily I don't know this for a fact, I hope I never do, but it's, I would imagine you are much less verbally dexterous if you actually are looking down the barrel of a pistol. So, that was the real one, as it were. And it's not that Gale was cowardly. I think it was just a more genuine reaction, the one I would have had personally, I think.
Walt himself is a pretty good actor, not just Bryan Cranston playing him.
Yeah, that's on some meta level. It's I don't know where the acting starts and stops, but I mean, our actor who plays Walter White is a wonderful actor, and the character Walter White is a pretty good actor too. He's one of the world's greatest liars, this guy. If you watch the show, he comes up with these astounding, complex lies effortlessly, and he, you can say that's maybe his greatest skill, is his ability to lie, and also the thing that actually takes him further and further down that road to hell, as it were, quickly. These lies he's willing to tell his loved ones, his wife, his children, his child, his family. He's very good at it.
Is that where you see him going? To hell?
You know, I don't know. Maybe there's still redemption to be had. It's again, not to be... Well, I guess I am being coy, but I mean, you know, we all love... I'll speak for myself. I love stories of redemption, ultimately. I don't know that this one will turn out to be that, but I, you know, I love Christmas Carol. I love stories of someone who's pretty bad, redeeming themselves and becoming good.
You're making it hard for us.
Making it hard, but then again, to me, Walt is not the only character. He's the main character. He's the main character of the show. But he is not the only character who, you know, Jesse actually at this point personally means more to me than Walt does. And I want to see, I would hope to see, I'm not promising it, but I would hope to see some kind of a redemption for him, you know. But it's, you know, it sounds like BS, probably on some level, but you kind of let the characters take you where they're going. You try to tell, as I was saying earlier, try to tell the story as organically as possible, and sometimes the characters, I guess it's like playing with a Ouija board or something. They kind of steer you. So I don't have if I sat here and said I had the end of this whole thing figured out, I definitely do not. I would be lying. These characters are going to kind of tell us, the writers, where they need to head, and we kind of take their lead, and that's how we come up with the story. That's how we've been doing it from day one, and we don't know exactly where they're going. I have certain hopes and desires for them, but we'll see if we get, you know, we'll bring those things to fruition. I'm not sure yet.
Can I be that guy and ask what some of those hopes might be?
Well, as I say, I'd like to see some kind of redemption. I don't want this to be a dark and hopeless show, although it probably feels that way sometimes. But it's not my intention to do that. I just want to be honest about what a career choice like this could possibly lead to, which is if you decide to be a meth cook, it's probably not going to end well. But so I want to be honest, but we're not trying to be, believe it or not, we're not trying to be dark for dark's sake. So I would like to see redemption. What do you think? What would you like to see?
Well, I'd like to, I'm with you. I'd like to see redemption in all of them.
Yeah.
And I think Jesse, although at the end of this episode, it's kind of hard, but Jesse is on the verge of it all the time, and wants to do the right thing. He doesn't really have his heart in doing the wrong thing, but he does it out of weakness and out of at this point out of loyalty.
Loyalty, yeah. He's a good kid in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's a shame Walt's not a better role model, better father figure.
Right, because for me that final scene is almost more about Walt than it is Jesse. That's Walt firing the gun. It just happens to be Jesse's hand.
That's well put. Yeah. Yeah, that is true. He is his minion, it seems. Yeah. Although, if you saw the previous episode to that, Walt does step out of his safety zone and save Jesse. So they have a very strange and complicated kind of a platonic love affair there. It's a lot of love and hate going on there. It's a lot of high emotion.
Before we open up for a couple questions, I was hoping the two of you could maybe talk about how you started working together, because I do believe that it involves the Virginia Film Festival.
Yeah.
I was the judge. When was it?
It was 1989.
1989. I was a judge of the governor of Virginia had a screenwriting contest.
Still has it, yeah.
Still the governor's? I know there's a screenwriting contest.
Oh, is it not the governor's anymore? Okay.
I don't think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Back when it was the governor's screenwriting contest.
That's right. Governor Wilder, right?
Yeah, I believe right. So.
Anyway, I read a number of scripts, and one of them was a script called Home Fries, written by Vince Gilligan, and I gave him his award at the University Theater, which is no longer around now, right there at in the corner. And Vince and I met, and I really loved Home Fries, and we kept on talking. And you were then living in Richmond, right? You were back in Richmond.
I got very lucky because of this wonderful organization, and I had graduated NYU Film School, and I was living at home actually with my mom, plotting out my next move, trying to figure should I move to LA or what. So, and then you called me.
And we became friends, and we ended up making Home Fries with Drew Barrymore and Luke Wilson. And then we did another script of Vince's called Wilder Napalm. And I always thought that Vince should stay in Virginia because I thought he had such a unique voice. I'd never, as the most imaginative writer I'd ever read, and I thought he had such great compassion for all of his characters, no matter how fallen they were, or you know, he wrote some pretty strange characters, but he always wrote them with affection. Never talked down to any of his characters, and some great situations. And I thought that if he came to Hollywood, he'd become another Hollywood screenwriter and try and write what everybody else was writing, and. It was really the X-Files that brought you to Hollywood, right?
Yeah, I was living in bought a house because of the proceeds from luckily because of Home Fries getting bought and Wilder Napalm. That was the first movie he produced that I wrote, and the proceeds allowed me to buy a house in Powhatan. Lived in Powhatan for about 4 or 5 years, and things slowed down a little with the screenwriting, and luckily I got the opportunity to write for the X-Files, and that's when I moved out.
I kid Vince that he had some pretty lousy work habits at the time. So
it's true.
Watch television until 4 in the morning and get up sometime mid-afternoon and maybe write a little bit.
I wish I had those 4 or 5 years back. I kind of pissed them away. Yeah, I did.
But then the X-Files really helped you both in terms of discipline, in terms of having to deliver a script at a specific time and not being able to take as much time as you had in the past, and also I think it really helped in terms of just how you plot out a script and what's got to happen at what point and so on. It was
And you were on X-Files for 7 years, right?
7 years on that show, and it was, I learned everything I know about TV from my boss on that show, Chris Carter, who created it. Great, great job, wonderful job. It was like being paid to go to film school, and yeah, I was lucky.
And I don't think I've ever read anything of Vince's that I didn't absolutely love, and doesn't mean that it can all get made. You know, Hollywood's pretty difficult these days, but we have at least two screenplays now that we're still in the process of putting together, and one of them Will Ferrell is attached to, and so we'll see. But I for one just hope that Breaking Bad just keeps going and going and going, because it's nothing like it on television. Those of you who've seen it, and it's not the most obvious thing. There's no reason in the world why this show should be on television. Yeah. But lo and behold, it is, and we get calls all the time from the greatest sources, people, writers, directors, actors, just saying, oh my gosh, this is the best thing on TV. We can't believe it's there. And it's all thanks to Vince.
No, it's thanks to you, and thanks to this wonderful, I was saying last night, I don't know where I'd be if I hadn't won the contest here. I don't know, who knows, maybe nowhere. It was a wonderful, it's a wonderful thing. Thank you guys, a wonderful thing.
Well, before we head out, do we have a couple questions in the audience right here?
Well, first
can
of all,
can you all hear the questions first of all in the back? The question is about the fly episode in which Walt and Jesse, or Walt, locks himself in the lab.
Yes.
Tries to kill a fly.
Well, first of all, you are right and your friends are wrong about we're very proud of that one. This is an episode we did. It was episode 10 of this season. It was 2-3 episodes before the one you just saw. And to be honest, we set out to do a bottle episode. A bottle episode refers to an episode that takes place pretty much in one location, and invariably, when you're doing a TV show, you run over budget, because budgets are very tight in TV and movies, and the money's always tight. And we were way over budget for season 3, and we tried desperately to get back on pattern, on our pattern budget. We wanted to save $200,000 or $300,000. And we did on that one episode, not the one you saw, but the fly episode. And it is really, it's Walt and Jesse in the super lab, and Walt is having kind of a meltdown. He feels so guilty about his brother-in-law, Hank, who is grievously wounded, and Walt shares quite a bit of responsibility for that happening in this terrible shootout. And he's just kind of having a meltdown. He's not sleeping, and the entire episode is Walt trying to kill a fly that he thinks is contaminating the batch of meth that they're cooking. And it's Walt, it's Jesse, his younger partner, kind of talking him off the ledge. And we're very proud of that episode. Ryan Johnson, I'm glad you mentioned him. He's a wonderful director. I think he's going to be the next. I liken it to Levinson and Link, the two producers of Columbo, must have thought way back in 1971 or so, when a young Steven Spielberg directed an episode of Columbo, which, by the way, if you haven't seen, I think he did one or two. You watch the first opening moments of the Spielberg episode of Columbo, you're like, somebody different is directing this thing. This is like, this guy's a master. I felt the same way those guys must have felt watching Ryan Johnson direct that fly episode. This guy, if you haven't seen the movie Brick, by all means, go rent it. It's a small, low-budget movie shot in San Clemente, California, probably 5-6 years ago, about it's sort of film noir set in a high school, and it's fantastic. And Ryan Johnson wrote and directed that, and then he did a movie called The Brothers Bloom, which is also excellent, very good. And we were lucky enough to get Ryan to do that particular episode, and the guy's brilliant. I can't say enough good things about him. We're going to try very hard to have him do an episode for season 4, but he's off doing a big science fiction movie. But we're very proud of that one. It is kind of a two-hander play with these two wonderful actors, and it was written by two former playwrights/actors who were on my writing staff, Moira Wally Beckett and Sam Catlin, and they did a hell of a job. And it is kind of a divisive episode, but I couldn't be more proud of it. It's you swing for the fences sometimes, and sometimes you miss, and sometimes you hit. I personally think that was a big hit. I love that one. But yeah, I've heard some people didn't dig it as much because there's no action. But we're proud of it. So thanks for digging it.
In the blue shirt.
Please wait for the microphone.
Oh, we do have audience or aisle mics. I'm sorry. I'll repeat the question. You can go ahead, and then we'll.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Hi, I have a question about, do you have any advice for people who want to get into TV or start making web shows with, like, distribution? Because, I don't know, there's some really good TV on, sometimes better than movies on TV right now. So, that's my question.
No, it's always a good question. How do you get your start, essentially? And, you know, part and parcel of that question is how do you get your agent? How do you get, and the best single advice I can give, as Mark spoke to a little while ago, it's tricky. When you want to be a lawyer, there's only one way to do it. When you want to be a doctor, there's only one way to do it. The maddening thing and the interesting thing about becoming a filmmaker, a writer, a director, an actor, is that there's about a million different ways to get to where you want to be. There's no one path. The path that worked best for me was entering contests. And luckily, because of the Virginia screenwriting competition, I'm up here today. It's what got me my start. Never underestimate that as a way of getting in. Write spec scripts, write spec pilots, write spec movie scripts. Whatever you're interested in, whatever story you have to tell, write it. That's where it all starts. Just put it on paper when nobody's paying you. Just get it on paper. But then I would suggest every legitimate competition you can enter your script into, enter it by all means. The Nichols Fellowship, that's a big national one. There's a lot more now than there was back in 1989. Enter the one here in Virginia. It's still ongoing, still an excellent competition. And the reason I say this is because a big draw with these competitions is that someone like Mark Johnson, in the more legitimate contest especially, is actually reading your script. Because let me tell you, when people come up and put their script in someone's hand, usually no one's ever going to read it. I mean, it's the simple truth of it. It's hard to get anyone in Los Angeles to read your script. And when it's someone who's agreed to be a judge in a contest, you actually have a captive audience, a captive reader in those kind of situations. It's a really good way to get in. As far as the web content goes, all this stuff is a little newer than my thinking. I don't know much about the web and all that, but I know that it seems like a cheap way to get your stuff on the air. So I would say shoot everything you can shoot, write everything you can write, put your product on YouTube and whatnot. And as far as getting it watched in the midst of the din of all the, you know, all the other YouTube videos that can be watched, I don't know how to guide you there, but write everything you can write and enter every contest you can enter. And don't think that an agent, you know, a lot of people say, how do I get an agent, because an agent will sell my stuff. It doesn't really work like that. You can speak to this too. Agents, it's a good thing to have an agent, but usually you get your first agent after you've sold your first project, your first script by yourself. And that's the way it was for me. That's the way it is for most everybody. Mm-hmm. You kind of sell that first one on your own. And as I say, in my case, by entering a contest. So.
Has the mic made its way somewhere? Or are you? Okay. Down here?
I want to ask a little bit about your involvement with Hancock, you know, the torturous history going
from the first draft to what eventually showed up on screen. And I wanted to know or ask, how were you involved with it? What did you bring in particular to what we ended up seeing a couple of years ago?
I did a rewrite. Hancock was originally a script called Tonight He Comes, written by a very talented writer named Vi Vincent Noh, who I never actually met. It was a very serious, dark story, and I was hired by Michael Mann and Akiva Goldsman, the two producers, to put some comedy into it. And I worked on it for 4 years. I did 25, 30 drafts. I finally had to quit under very unpleasant circumstances to go do the pilot for Breaking Bad. And the finished movie I saw once, didn't care for it that much, but but it's I don't, you know, it was a long, painful job, but I get paid for it, so I'm glad. I'm glad I did Breaking Bad instead of did another 5 or 10 drafts of Hancock. Yeah, thank you. But it was, you know, it's just a job. It would have been more painful the way it all worked out if I had originated the idea. But as I say, I was just a writer for hire, albeit for, you know, the length of a presidential term, you know, so 4 years or how long it takes to get through college. It was just like, I can't even believe how long that damn job went. But
when is season 4
there? That's a good question. Season 4 of Breaking Bad has been pushed off a little bit by our network, AMC, because they are now going to have year-round programming. As what I mean by that is they're going to have 4 shows on the air now instead of just the 2, Mad Men and Breaking Bad. And because of that, they want to push us back a little further into next year. Long story short, probably about the midpoint of June of next year, it'll come back on the air. It's a bit of a wait, unfortunately. About 3 weeks before season 4 starts airing, so early June, around, when's Father's Day? Sometime around Father's Day, I think.
I've got some in my trunk that I'll sell you later.
You might need to shout, but down here in the red.
I understand that most of your writing is character-driven, but entertainment media is so influential on popular culture. You can almost consider yourself as policymakers of the, you know, of the public opinion. Does that ever affect your writing at all?
Well, that's an interesting question. Entertainment is very influential. I don't think I write the kind of entertainment that's particularly influential. I think to be influential, first of all, you have to have a much bigger viewership than Breaking Bad has. We only have, 1.75 million viewers a week or 2 million when we're on the air. I wish we had more, but it's, you're right, modern popular culture does seem to influence, I don't know how much influence it has, but I don't think that's our show. I think that shows like, name something. I think, reality stuff like Dancing with the Stars has some effect on the culture. But thank you for thinking that ours does. I don't know that it does. I don't think we have that big a footprint, but it'd be nice to think so.
How about right in the front here?
Mm-hmm. And a flashback of like Walter and Gretchen discussing what makes up a human body back from long ago.
Right.
And before the title sequence starts, it leaves off with Walter making a question of like what could possibly be that missing thing that makes up the human body.
Mm-hmm.
Was it wrong of me to extrapolate a broader question out of that? And will you guys be going back to any of that? Or was that just simply to contrast between what they're breaking down a human body in a classroom and breaking down a human body in a house?
The question is what makes up that 0.00006% of the human body that is not matter?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I like that question. I guess we were thinking along broader lines, you know, what accounts for the soul, if you will, what accounts for makes a person, we're all made up of essentially the same trace elements and mostly carbon and oxygen and hydrogen, and so what makes us unique, what makes us individuals, what gives us our individuality and our personality and our soul, if you will. I don't know if that'll come back necessarily, but I think that's what we're being a little artsy fartsy, but that's what we're. Yeah. Good. Cool. Yeah. Thank
you. How about in the back there?
First of all, congratulations. You have an incredible show.
Thank you.
I've been there since day one, and I put a lot of my friends onto your show. My question is with regards to the wife, the character who plays Walt's wife. In this last season, we saw her start to maybe walk down that dark path. And I'm wondering if, to the extent that you can tell us, are we going to continue to see some of that in season four?
Well, I need to be a little bit coy, but having said that, you nailed it. I mean, you only have so many choices when you're married to a guy like that. You either run away screaming, or you go to the police, or you don't. And we, through little baby steps, we slowly but surely have. I mean, she was presented with the obvious choices, and she couldn't quite bring herself to, you know, bear witness against her husband and you know, the illegal deeds he's been up to. So, barring that, you know, you either stick around or you don't. And she has made baby steps toward potentially being the money laundress for his. She has a character-wise, she has a bookkeeping background, and she knows how to keep books. And she know, we've also shown she knows how to fudge the books. That place she worked briefly in last season. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if you see a little more of that in season four coming up.
I think we've got time for just one more question. How about right here?
When you have your, you set your storyline and you don't have an end. You've talked about how it's developing all the time. I'm feeling these days that the death of television is not having an end in sight. So they canceled these shows and they're just gone now. They didn't even talk to you about it. They don't even give you, you only got 3 weeks left or, you know.
Yeah.
It's just gone. And
yeah.
It's killing television.
That's an excellent question. The question being, you know, TV suffers by not having an end date. Either some shows, in general, some shows end before their time. They just get cut off by the network because the numbers, the viewership numbers aren't so good. Or other shows kind of putter along endlessly without, you know, some shows, in other words, to put it succinctly, some shows get cut off too soon, other shows go too long. And it's a very good question. And I can tell you that I want very much, I think I speak for you as well, to know the end date for Breaking Bad. But the business is not geared toward giving end dates. In other words, we're all kind of, you know, making it up as we go along. Is the core truth of it, and the companies we work for, the Sony Television is our studio in this case. Sony TV does not make any money off this show unless we have X number of episodes, somewhere in the 70s. This episode here was number 33. So they want us to go, you know, another three seasons probably. I'm not sure I can keep this show going story-wise for another three seasons. So there is an innate tension between Sony and myself. You know, and they're good guys. I love working for them. We wouldn't have anything if it weren't for them. But they have a desire that I don't necessarily share. Part of me wants to end this show at the end of season five, which would be two more seasons. I don't want to jump the shark. I don't want to have a show that is still on the air and people say, is that thing still on? That used to be a good show. And now, I would rather end too soon rather than too late, but I want to have a proper ending. And I think I speak for probably every showrunner out there. I think we all want to have a proper ending for our babies so that we've worked so hard, blood, sweat, and tears, you know, for. But it's not up to any one person because there are different companies involved and different sets of desires and needs, and that TV show Lost, wonderful show, good guys who created it. They did a very smart thing and a very unique thing when they said, however many years ago, they said, we're going to do three more years and out, and on blank date in 2010, you know, it's going to be over. They had to fight like hell. I've talked to both of them, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, who created it or who ran it. they both said, I said, how did you do that? Because that's what I'm trying to do with my show. And they said, we had to threaten to quit. And we had to mean it, because you don't ever threaten to quit unless you mean it. Because you got to be able to do it. You got to be ready to do it. But they threatened to quit, and it was a huge hit. It was a huge juggernaut success, which this is not, you know, money-wise or in viewership-wise. So that was a unique situation. I don't think you're going to see that become the norm. I kind of wish you would. They kind of do it better in England. You know, a show like The Office, the original British Office, they did 6 episodes a season. And they did 2 seasons, and then Ricky Gervais said, yeah, I'm kind of done. So, but it's just not the way the American business is geared. So I don't think you're going to see it anytime soon become the norm, unfortunately.
How many Emmys did you lose?
I don't know. I'm not complaining. I love the fact all you guys are here. I don't feel short shrifted by having a show like Breaking Bad is never going to have the viewership of a show like Lost. We're lucky to be on. As Mark said, I don't even know how this show is even on the air. We're lucky to have it on the air. Thank you for being here. And
I think I speak for everyone here in thanking you for coming out.
Oh,
it's been a great
night. Thank you guys.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Thank you. This is fun.
I had a blast. Yeah.